Today is December the 16th, 2020. Oh yeah, it's Beethoven's birthday. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave me a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The exodus of companies from California continues. Oracle is the latest tech company to relocate out of California. Oracle is moving its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Austin, Texas, and HP Enterprises announced its move to Houston early this month. Bloomberg News first reported that Oracle is the latest tech company to move its headquarters out of California. The company said on Friday it's moving its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Austin, Texas. An Oracle spokesperson confirmed with the following statement. Oracle is implementing a more flexible employee work location policy and has changed its corporate headquarters from Redwood City, California, to Austin, Texas. We believe these moves best position Oracle for growth and provide our personnel with more flexibility about where and how they work. A bulk of employees can choose their office location or continue to work from home part-time or full-time. In addition, we will continue to support major hubs for Oracle around the world, including those in the United States, such as Redwood City, Austin, Santa Monica, Seattle, Denver, Orlando, and Burlington, among others, and we expect to add other locations over time. By implementing a more modern approach to work, we expect to further improve our employees' quality of life and quality of output. Oracle is one of Silicon Valley's older success stories, founded in Santa Clara in 1977. It moved into its current headquarters in 1989. Several of the buildings on its campus there are constructed in the shape of a squat cylinder, which is a classic symbol in computer system design for a database, the product on which Oracle built its empire. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise announced early this month that it would relocate its headquarters from San Jose, California to Houston, Texas, and data analytics software company Palantir Technologies also moved its headquarters to Denver, Colorado, from Palo Alto, California, earlier this year. Tesla and SpaceX chief Elon Musk also confirmed that he moved to Texas, though his companies still maintain their major operations in California. Larry Ellison, Oracle's co-founder and chairman, serves on Tesla's board. Ellison has a long-standing friendship with Michael Dell, whose computer company is founded and remains headquartered in the Austin area. This is an exodus that began even before the pandemic. Last year, a study by consulting firm Spectrum Location Solutions found 660 California companies moved 765 facilities out of the state in 2018 and 2019. Those were booming years in the economy. Entrepreneurs and venture capitalists have been decamping now because of the high cost of doing business in Silicon Valley. Many were spending almost 3 hours in the car every day commuting from San Francisco to Palo Alto. There are other reasons for ditching Silicon Valley. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal this week, Musk attributed his move to a bevy of reasons, including what he views as California's unfriendly business environment. California comes in dead last when it comes to the most burdensome regulatory structure for business. According to a 2015 report from Pacific Research Institute, California's relative high personal income and capital gains tax rate, as well as the congestion and sky-high real estate practices, may not be worth it without the in-person opportunities to hobnob and collaborate, which is why the coronavirus pandemic might be accelerating this trend as more people work remotely. The work-from-anywhere trend that started with the COVID lockdown created a major paradigm shift in corporate norms, and definitely influenced some companies to move. Employees learned that expensive office space or campuses were not necessary for a large percentage of their workforce. Further, employees of these companies learned that they did not have to commute 2 hours a day from their affordable housing in the neighboring communities to ultra-expensive urban centers of commerce. The technology for a remote workforce already existed. However, California's elected officials, for their part, argue that the exodus is grossly overblown. Unless you have been on-site at a shipyard or an oil field to conduct business, the need for proximity has been forever changed by technology. California businesses are leaving the state in droves. In just 2018 and 2019 economic boom years, 765 commercial facilities left California. This exodus doesn't include the 13,000 estimated businesses that have left between 2009 and 2016. The reason is plain and simple: economics. California got to be too expensive, and its taxes and regulations are way too high. IBM squeezes 16,000 write erase cycles from QLC flash. QLC is 4-bit level NAND cell flash, and IBM says it has managed to attain TLC, which is 3-bit class endurance and performance, from the use of cheaper QLC flash chips. Quad-level cell flash is cheaper to make than triple-level cell flash and increases storage density, but at the cost of performance and endurance. QLC stores 4-bit of data using 16 states. This requires 16 voltage levels with lengthens I/O operations and means it takes longer to read and write data than TLC. This also shortens endurance expressed as write-erase cycles. To overcome this, IBM has developed a controller for its proprietary flash core module, that's FCM, drives that monitor and classify blocks of flash for health and longevity. Data blocks that are written most frequently are put on the healthiest flash blocks. IBM is said to have developed algorithms that can tell early on how healthy a flash block is going to be. By knowing that early, they can put data that's changed the most on the healthiest blocks and data that changed least on less healthy blocks. They get about a 2x increase in endurance by doing that. To overcome the performance limitations, they have developed smart data placement. So early in the life of the flash, they will define it as SLC or 1-bit level cell. As it is, SLC, we can only hold about 20% of the capacity of the device as SLC. And if you're using compression that has been built in and you're getting a 3-to-1 compression ratio, that's like a 60% of the capacity now. You're going to hold a lot of data now, and it's just enough like SLC that you end up getting better performance. As the device converts to QLC over time, they use smart data placement in which they put the data that's read the most in the fastest pages. All these things combined helps to overcome the negative effect of QLC. Solid-state devices are logically made up of flash blocks. These, in turn, are made up of pages, which are the smallest elements, that's groups of cells, that can be read in a solid-state device. With TLC, that's 3-bit cell level, IBM put solid-state devices on test and got 18,000 write-erase cycles. With QLC, that's 4-bit, they got 16,000 write-erase cycles. Ordinary QLC has 1,000 or so write-erase cycles. That's a huge difference between 16,000 and 1,000. Over-provisioning can lift this number, but nowhere near IBM's 16,000 level. These more sophisticated controllers will be able to get more from less. NAND makers don't want to test endurance, so they specify it extremely conservatively. Endurance testing takes considerable time to perform. The two key issues with QLC are endurance and slow write performance, and there are ways to get around both of these issues in software firmware or through some form of write affinity, that is to say, all writes go to small layers of much more durable solid-state media and later gets destaged to or moved over to QLC in a manner which very much minimizes write and garbage collection. You have three mechanisms that can boost endurance: better controller, better understanding of the medium, and over-provisioning. IBM was able to get 16,000 performance endurance from QLC by providing all three. All this work eventually filters down to lower levels simply because cost gets driven out over time, and all of the techniques that IBM is using should eventually be found in everyday data center solid-state devices and eventually into client solid-state devices. I can't wait for that to happen quicker. Caveat emptor. Solid-state makers swap parts without telling us. Would you like to know how exactly what the solid-state device you're buying is capable of when you purchase it at retail? Unfortunately, that's becoming more difficult because some solid-state device manufacturers are now changing not only the NAND flash, but also the SSD controller after the original product has been released and reviewed, but they aren't disclosing that practice to customers. Testing labs have shown that the changes have a big impact on performance. Most solid-state device makers launch a new product and try to stick to that hardware component layout for the entirety of the solid-state device lifecycle. When hardware changes are made, or even in some instances, just the firmware, the company will launch a new SKU. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case, and changing the NAND flash, which can have a big performance impact, has become a common but questionable practice in the solid-state device industry. Now that trend has evolved into a more worrisome pattern. Some smaller solid-state device manufacturers are now silently changing the SSD controller too, which has even broader implications. In a perfect world, the components in an SSD wouldn't change without a corresponding change in the spec sheet and product listing. Top-tier brands and especially SSD makers that fabricate their own flash storage tend to use the same hardware component configurations from the product launch until the day the SSD is cycled out for a new product. But that doesn't always happen. Component swapping is becoming more commonplace. It isn't uncommon to see a shipping SSD model with different NAND than the original configuration. These changes usually come at a time of high flash demand and low supply, and they certainly aren't always for the buyer's benefit. Performance may vary from configuration to configuration, with some products having gained competitiveness while others have fallen down the rankings. Companies swap out components several times, and while it's becoming more frequent, fully disclosing the change is becoming less common, and now SSD controller swapping is becoming more prevalent. Third-party SSD makers typically select an SSD controller from merchant silicon maker to power their SSDs. However, each SSD controller model, even from the same company, can have an impact on SSD performance. And naturally, controllers from two different companies can be completely different. This changing of components hasn't always been welcomed by customers and potential buyers, especially when the new product performs worse than the original. The flash and SSD controller markets can be volatile, with availability changing based on market conditions. The need to meet demand and that manufacturer have to be resourceful with the supplies available to them, especially in times of scarcity. But at the end of the day, the fact is that the changes performed made don't provide the same excellent user experience based on reviews. Because of the pairing and firmware configurations, the newer revisions may have a lower performance. It's tough to say to be sure exactly what you're getting at all. There's no real way of knowing whether you're buying version 1, version 2, or version 3 unless you recheck the specifications of the specific unit you are ordering. Caveat emptor. I have cables all over the place with different connectors on the end of the cables. There is the mini USB, which I often mistake for the micro USB. These cables essentially perform the same functions, but with different connectors on them. Some of these cables can only be used to charge the cell phone. The same looking cables are also used to transfer data. There is no marking on these cables. You just have to trust the retailer to sell you the cable with the proper number of wires. Throw into the mix HDMI and micro HDMI. Again, they provide the same functions, but with different connectors. And then I have all types of power bricks with different connectors. Well, looks like it's changing. It looks like the USB-C will replace all these different connectors. USB-C is rapidly appearing on the storage devices, from flash drives to external hard drives. Both standard USB-C ports and the Thunderbolt 3 ports are widely used today. and that only sets the continue as time goes on. Thunderbolt 3 ports are a little more versatile than standard USB-C ports. Thunderbolt 3 ports work with all USB devices, but USB ports don't work with all Thunderbolt 3 devices. It's important to note that USB-C isn't always what it seems. USB-C is a connector, not a standard, like other versions of USB might be. The USB-C port usually uses the USB 3.1 standard, but can use older USB standards or another popular and powerful standard, the Thunderbolt 3. What devices use USB-C? There are a ton of different kinds of devices that USB-C ports. Whether those ports uses the USB 3.1 standard or the Thunderbolt 3 standard, well, let's look at some of the devices. Perhaps the most obvious kind of device is the computer. Modern desktop and laptop computers all make use of the USB-C ports, meaning they can work with different kinds of peripherals. Remember, not all USB-C ports are created equal. Some laptops use USB-C just for charging, while some laptops use USB-C for charging and data transfer. Data transfer over USB-C also includes connecting to a wired Ethernet via an adapter. Since most USB-C connectors are thin and don't have a standard Ethernet port, many thin laptops also use USB-C ports for connecting to external displays in addition to charging and transfer of data, because it is slimmer than older video interfaces such as VGA and HDMI. High-end computers usually have Thunderbolt 3 ports instead of straight USB ports. Considering the fact that Thunderbolt 3 ports work with USB devices, it makes them a lot more versatile. With the right docking station or multi-port adapters, all of these functions can occur on one USB-C port. While these are perhaps the main devices that use USB-C ports, there are all kinds of other devices that will make use of USB-C. Often that's solely for the purpose of charging. For example, many recent external battery pack and power adapters have USB-C ports, but only to charge smartphones and laptops, and not for any kind of data transfer. USB-C is also cropping up in the automotive industry and will begin to be a commonly used charging standard in vehicles. Another major category with USB-C ports is mobile devices, like smartphones and tablets. Almost all modern smartphones offer a USB-C port for data transfer and charging, except, of course, the iPhone. Many tablets offer a USB-C port, too, including the iPad Pro. Other iPad models have yet to adopt USB-C. However, some expect Apple to move to USB-C on all mobile devices over the next few years. Be careful with USB-C ports on phones, because not all of them support video out. You'll want to check your mobile device specs to see if it supports DisplayPort Alternate Mode, which allows it to be connected to a display via USB-C. Really, anything that has a micro USB or USB-A could ultimately get a USB-C port. Devices like wireless mouse, keyboards, speakers, and smart home devices all either currently do or could in the future offer USB-C ports, both for power delivery and data transfer. USB-C is rapidly appearing on storage devices, from flash drives to external hard drives, thanks to USB-C's 10 gigabits per second transfer rate. Even some displays have USB-C ports, allowing you to simply connect a USB-C cable from your laptop to your monitor while simultaneously charging your laptop through that same monitor. In the future, the question is, what devices use USB-C should have a simple answer: everything. There's a reason so many devices use USB-C for power delivery. USB-C can transfer much more power than the previous versions of USB, meaning that larger devices like laptops can be powered through USB-C. USB-C supports up to 100 watts of power, which is easily enough to power larger devices like laptops. Older USB standards only supported 5-volt charging, which was perhaps enough to charge a pair of headphones or your phone, but not much more than that. Other devices make use of USB-C to add ports and functionality to your computer. On a laptop with only USB-C or Thunderbolt 3 ports, sometimes you might want to add extra ports for older peripherals or other connectivity. That's where USB-C hubs and docking stations come in. With a hub, you can add ports like HDMI ports, Ethernet ports, older USB ports, and more, all through a single USB-C connection. There are also adapters which essentially convert a USB-C port into another port. This might come in handy for people like photographers or videographers who need an SD card slot but don't have one built into their computer. What is there not to like about the USB-C cable? Not all USB-C cables are equal. USB-C stands for the shape and the type of connector, which is the same for all USB-C cables, but not all cables support the same kind of protocol and transfer speeds. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Volume License Agreements.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is when we get down to business. This is where I spend just a little bit of time talking about the business world and many times how it applies to you. In this case, I want to talk about something called the Volume License Agreement. We've all been there. We've all gone and we've gone to the grocery store. We've purchased just a single vegetable or fruit or what. I'll use an apple. And you know you can buy just an individual apple, or you can buy an individual potato or carrot or whatever. But over off to the side, there is that, you know, 3-pound bag of carrots. There's that 5-pound bag of apples. There is that 20-pound bag of potatoes. Now, you can buy the one apple and it's going to run you about, whatever it is, $1 or 58 cents or whatever. But you can buy the entire bag of apples, 5 pounds of those, for a lot less per apple. You get a dozen apples for a matter of about $3, or you get the one apple for, 50, 60 cents. Well, if you're really into the apples and you're going to use them all, you're going to go for that big old bag of apples. And same thing with the potatoes or the carrots. And it all depends on what you're making and what your household is going for. Or maybe it's just a matter of, I need only one potato and I have nothing on my radar. I don't like potatoes or apples or carrots or whatever it is. I don't like this particular thing. I just need one for this one recipe just to kind of round it out. All right. So the same way, we can apply that towards software. And that's where these volume license agreements come into play. You can purchase one single license for Microsoft Office. But what happens when you have 1,000 employees? Are you going to pay that much larger amount? No, Microsoft gives you a discount. Microsoft comes along and says, hey, you're buying 1,000 of them. We really like that. We're going to give you each of those at 20, 30, 40, 50% off. All you have to do is you buy X amount of these licenses. Now, we may think right now, you're sitting here, you're thinking, how does that apply to me? I'm not going to get any benefit out of this. And the reality is, sometimes, with some of these different volume license agreements, at least in some forms of them, and it might not necessarily be Microsoft, it might be Adobe, it might be whoever. There's many different software manufacturers out there that say, hey, we want to increase our install base. We go back for me. This is probably about 15 years ago. I worked for a company and we set up a volume license agreement for our antivirus software. Now, that antivirus software gave us a number of licenses for all of our computers across the organization. But the antivirus company came to us and said, we're going to do you one better. That license goes for all of your individual systems within the company, but we're also going to extend that to all of your employees. All of your employees can have this very same software for free. We're throwing this in. This is a perk for your employees. And it turned out to be a perk for them, too. Why was it a perk for them? Well, if the company I worked for moved on from that license agreement, well, all of those people would have to have a new antivirus software. Or would they just upgrade to that same software and pay directly? Oh, that's an interesting approach. And it worked, I'm sure, for them. Another thing that came along with that was the overall concept of protecting the hardware and software and the data of the company that I was working for, but also of all of the employees. What is one of the different transmission vectors for malware? It's coming from your personal system, going to your work system, and then going throughout your work system to all of the work systems. At that point in time, everything gets pretty ugly. So by doing that, by developing this, they were protecting themselves as well as the company, as well as, yes, the employees. See, if you can stop it in one spot, if you can identify it in location A, it won't get to location B. And location B is the one that's really important. And vice versa. So this volume license agreement is a thing that happens through many different companies. If you have anywhere near 50 PCs or more at your company, it would be well worth you going to the IT folks and saying, hey, I know about volume license agreements. Are there any different software packages that I can load on my home system that are available through the company, through us, and that are available free of charge or even at a reduced rate? Yes, there are reduced rates as well. There are a lot of companies that, they've got the volume license agreement and the main software company says, hey, we will sell additional licenses to your folks for a discount just because we like you. This is all amazing stuff. And it might be a way for you to save a few coins. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The basic solid-state device, also known as the solid-state drive. To understand how and why SSDs are different from spinning disk, we need to discuss a little bit about hard drives. A hard disk drive stores data on a series of spinning magnetic disks called platters. There's an actuator arm with read-write heads attached to it. This arm positions the read-write heads over the correct area of the drive to read or write the information. Because the disk heads must align over the area of the disk in order to read or write data, and the disk is constantly spinning, there is a delay before data can be accessed. The drive may need to read from multiple locations in order to launch a program or to load a file, which means it may have to wait for the platters to spin into the proper position multiple times before it can complete the command. This is what is called latency. Latency in hard disk drives is measured in milliseconds, compared with nanoseconds for your typical CPU. 1 millisecond is 1,000,000 nanoseconds, and it typically takes a hard disk drive 10 to 15 milliseconds to find the data on the drive and begin reading it. The hard disk drive industry introduced smaller platters on disk memory cache and faster spindle speeds to counteract this trend. But there's only just so fast drives can spin. The fastest spinning drive with the largest cache and smallest platter are still slow as far as your CPU is concerned. How are solid-state devices different? Solid-state devices are called that specifically because they don't rely on moving parts or spinning disk. Instead, data is saved to a pool of NAND flash memory. NAND itself, that's A-A-N-D, is made up of what are called floating gate transistors. Unlike the transistor designs used in DRAM, or D-R-A-M, which must be refreshed multiple times per second. By the way, DRAM is also called dynamic memory because it has to be refreshed. NAND flash is designed to retain its charged state even when the system is not powered up. This makes NAND a type of non-volatile or static memory. With NAND memory, electrons are stored in the floating gate, which then reads as charge 0 or not charge. 1, yes, in NAND flash means zeros, and data, which then reads as charge 0 or not charged. It's the opposite of how we typically think of a 0 or 1. NAND flash is organized in a grid. The entire grid layout is referred to as a block, while the individual rows that make up the grid are called a page. Common page sizes are 2K, 4K, 8K, or 16K, with 128 to 256 pages per block. Block size, therefore, typically varies between 256 KB and 4 megabytes. One advantage of this system should be immediately obvious. Because solid-state devices have no moving parts, they can operate at speeds far above those of typical hard disk drives. NAND is nowhere as fast as main memory, though, but it's multiple orders of magnitude faster than a hard disk drive. While write latencies are significantly slower for NAND flash than read latencies, they still outstrip traditional spinning media. Note how adding more bits per cell of NAND has a significant impact on the memory's performance. It's worse for writes as opposed to reads. Typical triple-level cell, that's TLC latency, is 4 times worse compared with single-level cell, that's called SLC. Erase latencies are also significantly impacted, and the impact isn't proportional either. TLC NAND, which is nearly twice as slow as MLC NAND, and TLC NAND means there's 3 bits in the cell. The reason TLC NAND is slower than MLC or SLC has to do with how data moves in and out of the NAND cell. With SLC NAND, the controller only needs to know if the bit is 0 or 1. With MLC NAND, the cell may have 4 values, 00, 01, 10, and 11. With TLC NAND, the cell can have 8 values, and QLC, which is 4 bits in a cell, has 16. Reading the proper value out of the cell requires a memory controller to use a precise voltage to ascertain whether any particular cell is charged. One of the functional limitations of solid-state devices is that while you can read and write data very quickly to an empty drive, overwriting data is much slower. This is because a solid-state device reads data at the page level, meaning from individual rows within the NAND memory grid, and can write at the page level, assuming surrounding cells are empty. They can only erase data at the block level. This is because the act of erasing NAND flash requires a high amount of voltage. While you can theoretically erase NAND at the page level, the amount of voltage required stresses the individual cells around the cells that are being rewritten. Erasing data at the block level helps mitigate this problem. The only way for a solid-state device to update an existing page is to copy the contents of the entire block into memory, erase the block, and then write the contents of the old block plus the updated page. If the drive is full and there are no empty pages available, the solid-state device must first scan for blocks that are marked for deletion but haven't been deleted yet. Then they go through an erase phase, and after that they write the data to the now erased page. This is why solid-state devices can become slower as they age. A mostly empty drive is full of blocks that can be written immediately. A mostly full drive is more likely to be forced through the entire program erase sequence. If you use solid-state devices, you likely heard of something called garbage collection. Garbage collection is a background process that allows a drive to mitigate the performance impact of the program erase cycle by performing certain tasks in the background. The next concept in solid-state devices that you might have heard is called TRIM, T-R-I-M. When you delete a file from Windows on a typical hard disk drive, the file isn't deleted immediately. Instead, the operating system tells the hard drive it can overwrite the physical area of the disk where that data was stored the next time it needs to perform a write. This is why it is possible to undelete files and why deleting files in Windows doesn't typically clear much physical disk space until you empty the recycling bin. With a traditional hard disk drive, the operating system doesn't need to pay attention to where data is being written or what the relative state of the blocks or pages is. However, with a solid-state device, this does matter. The TRIM command allows the operating system to tell the solid-state device it can skip rewriting certain data the next time it performs a block erase. This lowers the total amount of data the drive writes and increases solid-state device longevity. Both reads and writes damages NAND flash, but writes do far more damage than reads. And the last two concepts in the solid-state device is about wear leveling and write amplification. Because solid-state devices write data to pages but erase data in blocks, the amount of data being written to the drive is always larger than the actual update. If you make a change to a 4-kilobyte file, for instance, the entire block that 4K file sits within must be updated and rewritten. Depending on the number of pages per block and the size of the pages, you might end up writing 4 megabytes worth of data to replace a 4-kilobyte file. Garbage collection reduces the impact of write amplification, as does the TRIM command. Keeping a significant chunk of the drive free and or manufacturer over-provisioning can also reduce the impact of write amplification. Wear leveling refers to the practice of ensuring certain NAND blocks aren't written and erased more often than others. While wear leveling increases a drive's life expectancy and endurance by writing to the NAND equally, it can actually increase write amplification. In order to distribute writes evenly across the disk, it is sometimes necessary to program and erase blocks even though their contents haven't actually changed. A good wear leveling algorithm seeks to balance these impacts. And what does all that work? It's called the solid-state device controller. It should be obvious by now that solid-state devices require much more sophisticated control mechanism than hard disk drives do. Solid-state device controllers, however, are in a class by themselves. They often have a DDR3 or DDR4 memory pool to help with managing the NAND itself. Many drives also incorporate single-level cell cache that acts as buffers, increasing drive performance by dedicating fast NAND to read-write cycles. NAND flash in a solid-state device is typically connected to the controller through a series of parallel memory channels. The drive controller performs some of the same load balancing work as a high-end storage array, but solid-state devices don't deploy RAID internally, but wear leveling, garbage collection, and single-level cell cache management. Some drives also use data compression algorithms to reduce the total number of writes and improve the drive's lifespan. The solid-state device controller handles error correction, and the algorithms that control for single-bit errors have become increasingly complex. NAND flash performance is determined by the underlying controller. Solid-state devices use SATA ports just like hard disk drives. In recent years, however, it's shifting to M.2 drives, very thin drives, several inches long, and that slots directly into the motherboard. NVMe is the latest and, of course, the greatest storage interface for laptops and desktops, and it offers much faster read and write speeds than older interfaces. This comes at a cost, though, so depending on what you use the computer for, buying a non-volatile memory drive may not make sense. Non-volatile memory drives offer higher performance than traditional SATA drives because they support a faster interface. Conventional solid-state devices attached via SATA top out at about 550 megabytes per second in terms of practical read-write speeds. M.2 drives are capable of substantially faster performance into the 3.2 gigabytes per second range. What are NVMe drives? Non-Volatile Memory Express, that's NVMe, is a storage interface introduced in 2019. Non-volatile means the storage isn't erased when your computer reboots, while Express refers to the fact that the data travels over the PCI Express interface on your computer's motherboard. This gives the drive a more direct connection with your motherboard since data doesn't have to hop through a serial advanced technology attachment, otherwise we call SATA controller. NVMe drives are much, much faster than SATA drives that have been around for years. PCI Express 3.0, the current generation of the PCI Express standard, has a maximum transfer speed of 985 megabytes per second on each lane. NVMe drives have been able to utilize 4 PCI Express lanes, meaning a theoretical maximum speed of 3.9 gigabits per second. Meanwhile, one of the fastest SATA SSDs, the Samsung 860 Pro, tops out at read and write speeds of about 560 megabits per second. NAND flash offers an enormous improvement over hard disk drives, but it isn't without its own drawbacks and challenges. Shrinking process nodes are a significant challenge for NAND flash, while most hardware improves as the node shrinks. NAND becomes more fragile. Thus far, we've seen drives with up to 96 layers in the market. 128 layers seems plausible at this point, and IBM just recently announced 176 layers. Overall, the shift to 3D NAND has helped improve density without shrinking process nodes or relying on planar scaling. Intel's 3D XPoint has emerged as one potential challenger to NAND flash, and the only current alternative technology in mainstream production. Intel's Optane, that's what they call it, solid-state device, doesn't use NAND. They're built using non-volatile memory, believed to be implemented similarly to phase-change RAM. Drive latency is also roughly half of NAND flash and vastly higher endurance. Well, what about the Intel Optane? The Intel Optane drive is also based on the NVMe interface and PCI Express bus, but uses the new 3D XPoint flash memory developed by Intel for optimum performance, and Optane solid-state devices offer extreme performance and fast latency, but they are expensive. NVMe, or Non-Volatile Memory Express, is a communication interface and driver that defines a command set and feature set for PCI Express-based solid-state devices with the goals of increased and efficient performance and interoperability on a broad range of enterprise and client systems. NVMe was designed for solid-state devices. Here, the bottleneck is the NAND technology, which, however, is rapidly advancing, which means we'll likely see higher speeds soon with NVMe and higher densities with solid-state devices. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Snow belts. How snow outside impacts technology and people both outside and in.
For most of the population these days, the scariest thing about snow is that it may bring a power failure. But that isn't the only way that snow can belt you around. Tonight's report, Snow Belts, starts outside, where the snow is, then comes indoors for some of its effects and how it all connects with us. Start with the obvious. If it's snowing, it's cold out. If the snow is accumulating, it's even colder and the ground temperature is below freezing. Street temperatures have a different freeze point once they've been treated with salt or beet juice or other melts or de-icers. So snow accumulating on streets is a sign of an even deeper freeze. Before the snow started, was it raining? That means wires and tree limbs got wet, and the layers of snow closest to them are or soon will be ice. Snow has air gaps within and between flakes. Ice doesn't. That makes ice heavier. It also means there's a layer between the clear ice and the white snow that fell over it that has frozen wet snow, which might look gray. But focus your attention on those tree limbs gaining a lot of weight. They'll flex downward. Some will break. Major limbs and whole trees can come down. We had one of our backyard trees completely arch, pulling its roots out of the ground. One of the front yard trees snapped in two about 15 feet up. The yard and the drive are littered with branches, big and small. Can't leave them on the driveway. Some of them are big enough to take out a tire. Those wet snow events often come in the company of strong winds, and bang, that exacerbates the damage. What happens when a tree falls on your house? Roll the dice. It could be a yanked gutter, or a hole in the roof, or stowed in siding, or broken windows, or a hole in the wall. Or they might hit a car that's parked outside. And what happens when those big, wet limbs weigh down power and utility wires? Outages. Outages start without because they're outside. Outages also start without because they mean you're out of luck. They start without and they end with ages, because that's how long it takes for the utilities to get everything fixed. It's not like yours is the only house with an outage. But even before or just after the outage, some of the breakers on the power lines may try to reset themselves. You get little pop-up stutter outages, many of them less than a second long. A separate menu of nuisances come with those. And even when it's not trees and ice bringing the lines and utility poles down, slippery roads can send cars skating into utility poles. That sometimes ends up with live wires nearby, maybe nearer than you think. Consider this. Snow on the road, near the sides of the road and on driveways, will have been exposed to salts, chemicals, and dirt. They can make that snow electrically conductive. So, that downed live power can reach cars on the road. Snow and wet dirt on tires can make tires conductive. Wheels already are. And the chassis of a car can become electrified. So remember, avoidance and retreat by car are appropriate, but exiting the vehicle can prove fatally unwise. One more note about outside before we come inside. You see the snow. You probably can't see what's waiting underneath it. Look at your neighbor's rooftop or your own. Is there a strip along the ridge, you know, the peak of the roof, where the snow has melted? Know what melted it? Heat from the house. And melted snow is, right, water. So as it melts, it dribbles down your roof. It dribbles underneath the snow, which is cooling it. And by the time it reaches the edges of your roof, it freezes. That's called an ice dam. And all the melting and refreezing can send some of that water back up under your shingles or between your gutters and siding or into the walls and ceilings of the house. If there's just a five-figure bill for repairs, consider yourself lucky. The way to prevent that is to get into the attic and insulate the underside of the roofing boards to keep the rising heat from warming the ridge. So, indoors, look out the window. What's on the ground? Is it all snow or part ponding? Take a snapshot. Next spring, you'll want to do something about the lowered terrain that can let ponding happen. If you're lucky, it's just damage to the yard. If you're not so lucky, the basement or slab foundations may be in trouble. Ready to think about your tech? Let's start with your power lines and everything plugged into them. Those little flutter outages and quick reconnections subject them all to surges, spikes, and off-spec voltages. If you don't have your modems and routers on backup power supplies, you probably found yourself waiting for them to reboot and reconnect. Same for your cable boxes, your desktop PCs, and more. Not to mention the clocks on your stove and microwave and coffee maker and so on. When you ready your New Year's resolutions, it's about time to think about whole house surge protection, well before April showers. Fluttering power is more about nuisances than damage, but nearby lightning strikes, well, those can make your gear fry. That's not something to enjoy. Speaking of backups, power isn't your only concern, though it may be at the root of many others. Even if you have a gas furnace, without the HVAC fan blowing, the house won't be warming up. If you're on municipal water and have a gas water heater, you may be okay there for a while, but if you're on well water, your pump is out of the picture, so use that last flush carefully. Make sure your flashlights have fresh batteries and that everyone in any room knows how to get hands on a flashlight in the dark. Sure, you can use the phone as a flashlight, but that cuts into the battery time available for calls or data deeds. Without ventilation, non-electric indoor heaters can be dangerous. Get into sweaters early and have extra socks and blankets on standby. The food in your fridge is good for a day or two if you don't open it. If being hungry is making family members crazy, think in terms of cereal and crackers. You did remember to stow away a few cases of bottled water somewhere, didn't you? If your house becomes unlivable, how much do you know about available local shelters? It would be smart to know where they are before you need them. But when it's too late for that, ask the police. They at least pay attention. Also, your power outage does not excuse you from coronavirus precautions. If you have to leave home for a shelter or anywhere else, wear masks and, if possible, bring spares. And finally, if that fluffy white stuff is making it stunningly beautiful out your window, and you can't help yourself but to sing "Let It Snow," consider emending its lyrics to "The weather outside is frightening." Next time, we finally get to flip past the last calendar page of what may be mankind's worst year ever. But looking backward is nowhere near as productive as looking forward. So be here for my report, Turning 21, about the year when we all become grown-ups again. If you miss it, I'll stop the ball from dropping and you'll be stuck in a 2020 vision forever.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. Brookdale Computer Users Group. Are your bits flipped? Thursday, tomorrow, December the 17th, 2020. Meeting time is at 6:45 p.m. Via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. New York Amateur Computer Club. Speech recognition presentation, Thursday, January the 14th, 2021 at 7 p.m. Via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The following computer clubs haven't finalized their meeting time because of the pandemic and the holiday period. These are their websites that you can go to check when they have scheduled their next meeting. Princeton PC Users Group, ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group, limac.org, that's limac.org. Westchester PC Users Group, wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that is the acgnj.org. And finally, Computer Learning Center at Ewing, they closed up in March and they haven't restarted yet, and they're waiting for the ending of the pandemic to resume meetings. But their website is clcewing.org. That's clcewing.org. That's the Computer Learning Center at Ewing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of this program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again Same time, same station next week.